The estuary of the Thames is not beautiful. It has no noble features, no romantic grandeur of aspect, no smiling geniality. A strange air of mysteriousness which lingers about it to this very day, the suggestion of vastness caused by the configuration of the shore. These words were written by Joseph Conrad, and they were written about a location that is a crucial part of the story of London, even if we've not mentioned it too often. But it has always been there throughout this series. The lower parts of the Thames, where the river runs out to the sea. I mention this location because the start of this episode is directly there. And in 1290, something happened here that was, by all accounts, a little documented story of absolute horror. You see, there was a boat, a ship that had sailed from London, as far as we can tell, to head out to the sea. On board this ship were refugees, residents of England who had just been expelled and cast out of the country, exiles. The reason for their expulsion? They were part of the Jewish community of this land and of this city, we think, and they had just been ordered to leave the city and the nation by the king, Edward I. The Jews had hired a ship to take them to their new lives on the continent. But on the way out of the River Thames, the captain of the ship either read the tides wrong or failed some navigational check, because the ship became anchored in and perhaps upon a sandbank in the lower reaches of the Thames as the tide withdrew. Somehow, for reasons we do not fully understand, the captain persuaded his Jewish passengers to take a walk on the sandbank near the ship. Perhaps he told them the ship was too heavy and they needed to take a few moments off the ship so it could refloat itself as the tide came in. Perhaps he said it would be a good constitutional. We just know that they did leave the boat and walk some distance upon a sandbank only visible in the low tide. The captain was with them, but when they were far enough away, he fled back to the boat and left them. The ship sailed on, and the Jewish passengers were left to drown in the Thames as the tide rose again. The crew divided their property amongst themselves, and we imagine the screams upon the river sands of those innocent men and women, and we imagine those screams would have been haunting beyond comprehension. On the dark waters of the River Thames, surrounded by that barren shore on either side, a small act of unspeakable horror was enacted, and with this, we begin today's episode. Hi, my name is Saul, and you are listening to The Story of London, the podcast dedicated to telling the history of the city in regular weekly chunks. Each chunk takes us a little bit further along in the tale of the city, what was going on, who was doing what, and more. And this week we are approaching the year 1290. And the city of London finds itself feeding new wild animals in the Tower, facing wardens instead of mayors, holding big parties for women with leprosy. And of course, as that story illustrated, dealing with the horror of the end of London's Jewish community. Welcome then to chapter 105 of The Story of London, The Screams Upon the River Sands. We begin this episode with London under a new regime. The position of mayor had just been abolished by men loyal to the king, and the new warden of the city was now in charge of London, a man called Ralph de Sandwich. Now, Ralph was an interesting choice to be the warden. He wasn't a nobody. He'd been a supporter of de Montfort and his rebellion during the Second Barons' War, and he'd somehow survived the massacre and debacle of the Battle of Evesham. Afterwards, of course, though, his lands were confiscated, and he had begun a slow return journey back to respectability. And that journey had started in London. His uncle had been the Bishop of London, Henry of Sandwich, and when he'd been exiled to Rome, as I'd covered in a previous chapter, Ralph had been appointed administrator of the See of London. From this, he began to regain positions of trust and respectability under King Edward, and thus in 1285, when the king took direct control over the city, Ralph was appointed Warden of London on July 1st that year, and by September he was Constable of the Tower of London also. Ralph was de facto Mayor of London and presided over the Court of Hustings for the next 3 years. He was to be the power in the city. Of course, not everything had been removed from London. The sheriffs remained. Now, any new listener simply needs to be told at this point that sheriffs in this era had absolutely nothing especially to do with law enforcement. The sheriffs of the city were two men who agreed to pay the crown a large lump sum of cash that represented the yearly tax bill or farm from the city. They then spent the rest of the year collecting the taxes from others to make up the money they had spent and to make a bit of profit on the side. As such, the sheriffs played a continuing financial role. And Ralph de Sandwich's sheriffs, since they were raising money from Londoners, continued to come from the community of Londoners, and in particular, the oligarch class that had run the city for quite some time now. Over the next few years under Warden de Sandwich, we see Londoners continue to hold and hoard the post of sheriff. In 1285, you had Walter Le Blute, the fishmonger, and John Wade, the alderman of Vintry Ward. The next year, a man called Thomas Cross and Walter Hootin, the alderman of Coleman Street, held the positions of sheriff. Thomas Cross was, like Le Blunt the year before, a fishmonger, but he was also the alderman of Billingsgate. And in 1287, Warden de Sandwich was aided by William de Hereford of Aldgate Ward and Thomas de Stans, who was the alderman of Bread Street. So here is a London under new management, but clearly run under the tenets of the old management. On top of this, the king had decided round about 1286 to travel to France for some important diplomatic duties. He'd be out of the country for a few years, so oops, grown-up's gone, London's running itself. Ralph de Sandwich did very little to change the fabric of London when he was warden. In 1287, the by now garrison church of St. Peter ad Vincula, which had once been located outside but was now located entirely within the newly expanded walls of the Tower of London, was completely rebuilt. But on the whole, Warden de Sandwich's term is remarkably sedate. He was replaced in 1288 by a man called John Le Breton, who was aided by the alderman of Queenhithe, William de Begatine, and the alderman of Tower Ward, John de Canterbury. Warden Le Breton was actually more energetic. He oversaw the cleaning up of the Walbrook River. Like the River Fleet, the River Walbrook had been used as a sewer. It was in his term of office that it was ordered that the stream should be cleared of shite and other nuisances, and that any costs were to be charged to each house along its course. Meanwhile, the king, who was in France, as I said, and above all, he wasn't just visiting the lands of the French, he was visiting his own lands, the parts the English king ruled in Gascony, he sent back a lion and a lynx to the Tower of London to join the other animals there in the Tower's menagerie. The king allowed 10 pence a day for the upkeep of the animals and threepence each to a man and his three sons to be their keepers. It's not clear where this lion was housed. The Lion Tower of the Tower of London is to get its name much later, and it's thought this denoted a nearness to where the lions were kept. But in the same year, as well as these two large cats, a small sum of money was spent on the house of the elephant and the white bear, or polar bear, that were located in the tower at the same time. I do really wonder if the Norwegian who was allocated to look after the polar bear still existed in the tower, still took it down to the river each day, still allowed Londoners watch it feed. The tower and the wild animals were doing well. But the Warden of London wasn't. Now, there are conflicting sources and dates, but specifically it says that round about 1288 or 1289, quote, in the same year, the said Sir John Le Breton was removed and the said Sir Ralph was made warden as before, unquote. But it does not elaborate more than that. And Warden de Sandwich was replaced again later on by Warden Le Breton, and they held the post between them for the next few years. We do know that as 1290 dawned, there were complaints about the ongoing pollution of the River Fleet, which, like the Walbrook, was filled with shit and was particularly bad in its lower reaches. The White Friars of Newgate, who were about 200 yards away, complained to the King and the King's Court about the stench from the River Fleet, which they said was so powerful that it overwhelmed even copious amounts of use of incense in their church. Meanwhile, also in 1290, just outside of London, the leprous maidens gained the right to hold a fair. The who? Well, north of Westminster, there existed out in the countryside there a leper hospital, a lazar house, dedicated to St. James the Last. In 1290, in order to raise money for the leper hospital, which seems to have been for female lepers only, hence the reference to leprous maids, the hospital gained the privilege to hold a seven-day fair beside their home with all the tomfoolery that went with it. It is worth noting that the leprous women of the Hospital of St. James the Last lived at the site of what is today St. James's Palace in Westminster. Alas, we don't have leprous women there, or anywhere near as much tomfoolery. However, while this was going on, what 1290 really saw was the fall of London's Jewish community. And that needs some exploring. We do not know just how many Jews were left in England or in London at this point in time. Historians widely disagree as to the exact numbers of the population in the 1280s, with the overall national estimate said to be somewhere between 2,000 and 4,000 at most. These are usually seen as a sad rump of a once thriving national community. The consensus of most historians is that the Jews of England were, quote, reduced to the lowest depth of misery and degradation, unquote, in the years leading up to their expulsion. For many, the English Jewish community had simply been milked of the bulk of their wealth. As we saw during the political turmoils and civil wars of the 1260s, England's Jews had suffered persecution at the hands of bigots, opportunists, and partisans in the various civil wars. Then, a series of laws had been introduced, culminating in the Statute of Jewry of 1275, which had crippled the communities, and then this had been followed by the coin-clipping show trials and subsequent mass execution and confiscation of goods, which had only served to kick the Jewish community hardest when it was already down. Many Jews had seen their friends and relatives ruined, murdered, or executed during this period, and they would have surely seen very little point in remaining in England. And indeed, we can probably accurately guess that many would have left England of their own accord long before 1290. And so, superficially at least, there is every good reason to think that in the second half of the 1280s, England's Jewish community was a sorry shadow of its former self. And yet, they seem to be persevering, showing an incredible tenacity. Some Jewish traders had been able to actually become legitimate traders by involving themselves in their advanced credit for the sale of wool and cereals, and they'd managed to thrive. The Jews of London in particular were still hanging on. It's just that life for them was much rougher than it had ever been. Jewish money lending still continued, but Jewish lending was quote, overwhelmingly small scale, rural and short term, unquote. We're talking small sums of money were being lent to small men. Short term loans in London to small craftsmen. And that was often all a Jewish lender could manage. The community of London was hanging on by the skin of its teeth, seeking to survive via whatever methods was left to them by the Christians around them. The London synagogue had been closed. The streets of Old Jewry were deserted compared to what they had been. But there were rays of hope. Maybe not local ones, but as London's Jewish community shrank, York's Jewish community thrived. But nationally, this Jewish population was not the powerhouse it had once been in England. And proof of this lies in the monies extracted from them by the government. If you look between the years 1241 and 1246, £75,000 had been demanded by the royal government and paid, extracted from the Jewish community over those 15 years. Those self-same demands at the self-same rates over the 18 years between 1272 and 1290 raised only £9,300. And in fact, this loss of money-making revenue was one of the things that helped damn London's Jewish community. For the civil administrators of Edward's reign and for King Edward I himself, there was a growing realization that the Jewish community was no longer a required adjunct for future financial considerations in the land. They were no longer one of the three pillars of the city's money pit here in London. Indeed, as we know, King Edward had now shifted royal fund gathering and borrowing towards Italian merchants. And we know that in London this is reflected with Italian and Carosin, or Southern French, moneylenders and creditors expanding their influence right across the city. And here is a paradox. As London's Jewish community slipped into a worsening financial situation, potential borrowers would seek out alternative sources of credit, which would make the Jews' financial situation worse. However, what I'm describing here is a process of erosion, not extinction. Based on this, the Jewish community of London was certainly shrinking and diminishing, but it would be wrong to suggest it could not recover from this. Ever since that first brutal pogrom inflicted upon the Jews of London, triggered by the coronation feast of the rather totally useless King Richard I, which I covered all the way back in chapter 75, the Jewish community of London had always, no matter what was thrown at it, managed to recover and rebuild. So it could well have endured this moment around 1290 and rebounded. This was merely an economic crisis. But something else was at work. Something hardened Edward I's view towards his Jewish subjects. Something inevitably based in his own religious beliefs. And I think I know what. You see, in 1286, when Edward had visited France, we know he was travelling south from Paris, where he'd performed homage to the new French king Philip IV for his Duchy of Gascony, around June 1286. And as he travelled through France, King Edward fell seriously ill. Precisely what the nature of this illness was, we actually don't know, but it does appear to have caused him to fear for his life. And it may have been during this illness that the king vowed to go back on crusade again, a promise he never fulfilled. And it may have been because of the heightened religious sensibility Edward felt after recovering from this, that he ordered the expulsion of the Jews from his lands in Gascony at the end of 1287. The Gascony Jews were speedily arrested and their property was confiscated before they were expelled as fast as they could be. Now, the confiscation of those goods was so financially rewarding that many historians believe that Edward's motives for this expulsion of the Jews from Gascony was entirely driven by greed. Now, I will say, I don't feel learned enough to wade into the complicated reasons and explanations of what King Edward is up to in his time in Gascony, or comment if the expulsion of the Jews from Gascony was completely financially driven. But I do tend to side with those who believe that Edward's survival from whatever illness struck him down does seem to have been perhaps the primary instigator, the primary driver of his motivation to purge Gascony of Jews. Was this why, when he turned up to England, he then purged England of its Jews? To a degree, yes, but for me, ultimately, I feel what did for the Jewish community of London and England was ultimately domestic English politics. And in particular, the King's ongoing and complicated relationship with Parliament. The King was used to summoning this body of knights and land magnates maybe twice a year now, and it was getting into its stride, fulfilling its principal role as the main revenue-generating machine of the crown. The power politics of England during the reign of Edward I was simple. The king needed money. Parliament could supply that money in return for concessions from the king. In its most basic bare-bones arrangement, that was simply how Parliament worked. So here we are, round about 1288 and 1289. King Edward is in France. He's recovering from an illness and he's facing a short-term financial issue. And that was caused by, well, he's spending years abroad. The cost of maintaining an itinerant court abroad has been high. And the revenues from Gascony, even including the large-scale confiscation of the property of Jews, is not enough to meet Edward's expenses while he's been on the continent living life as a glorious English king. As a result, Edward's had to borrow heavily from his Italian financiers. He needs moolah, cash, and lots of it. So while still in France, round about February 1288, Edward had actually asked for an increase in national taxation in England to give him a large lump sum in order to pay for his debts. And the Parliament of England had simply said no. They were not prepared to grant a subsidy unless the king turned up in person. So when King Edward returned to England in about 1289, his financial situation was worrying him heavily. But he also had issues with the state of the kingdom. He'd been in charge for a while now. And the first wave of reforms and that new lick of paint he had placed upon England when he took over from his father was beginning to fade. And just like when he had 15 years previously when he came back from Crusade, the king was bent on reforming and reinvigorating his nation. In October of 1289, an assembly of the magnates, the Parliament, was summoned to come to London to meet in early 1290. But around the same time, Edward issued a proclamation inviting all those with grievances against royal officials to appear at Westminster that November and there to complain. What followed was a bit like one of those periodic purges of corruption that the Chinese Communist Party seems to do. The regime of Edward I sought to seek out corrupt officials who made his regime look bad. And inquiries and hearings, and notice how I don't say show trials, which eventually resulted from this proclamation, were to last until 1293. During this time, some great men, judges and royal officials, fell from grace. However, Edward's aim in his anti-corruption show trials was not to purge this class of men. It was more to improve the king's image to the country, an important step in the larger game of buttering up Parliament to give him more taxes. And so, in January 1290, the Parliament met in Westminster. But other affairs and issues in the land dominated for the few weeks it met. And frustratingly for the King, the assembly which gathered in Westminster in January or February of 1290 never discussed the issue of taxation. Another summons was issued, therefore, for the Parliament to meet after Easter. And as well as that, the king had to deal with another long-running set of internal disputes within his nations, which had been dragging glacially along. And to bring them over, he decided to come up with some reforms. I could go into it. There's politics happening. Edward is just working to get Parliament on his side so they could introduce a huge tax that could cover his outstanding debts to the scary Italian blokes in the corner. So on June 14th, therefore, the Knights of the Shire and the Members of Parliament were summoned to attend at Westminster. And then, around July, suddenly in the political agenda was the complete expulsion of England's Jews. Now, as long-term listeners may not be surprised to hear me say, the exact reasons and timings about what exactly followed are the source of much disagreement between historians. And non-historians may be inclined to ask about now, do historians disagree about just about everything? To which the answer is, yes, they do disagree about just about everything. And, as always, since the purpose of this podcast is to explain the narrative story of London, I take the conscious choice to try to avoid this row, as it has little to do with London, except in consequences. But allow me just to say that there is a debate going on between those historians who believe that Edward I went into this Parliament with his mind already made up to expel England's Jews, and those who disagree, who said the prospect of it was maybe on the table, but Edward merely had it as a possible move in case he needed to win over Parliament with a grandstanding, crowd-pleasing gesture in order to get his great big fat tax concession. There are entire books on this subject for those who are interested, and even the short summary I just gave you does not actually do this debate justice. Those who specialise in the history of this period, forgive me, I'm telling a story. What we do know is during the Parliament of July 1290, quote, the Commons representatives demanded as the price for their consent to the King's tax was the expulsion of the Jews from England, unquote. Now, for the record, there is no formal record of the parliamentary proceedings which confirms this, and it's just as likely that Edward raised the possibility of expelling the Jews in an effort to tempt the knights into granting him this much-needed tax. Doesn't really matter whoever mentioned it first. A direct or implied link between the expulsion of the Jews and the grant of the tax was seen by all at the time and was agreed upon. Things moved quickly. Orders were sent out by the 18th of July to the sheriffs of England. The Jews had until the 1st of November to leave the country, and the sheriffs were ordered to make sure that they were not attacked or injured while preparing themselves for departure or while travelling to the ports of the land. That final decision to expel the Jews from London came quickly and without much warning. Edward I, of course, profited significantly as a result of this. The tax he was finally granted by Parliament in July 1290 was assessed to have raised for him roughly £116,346, probably the largest single tax of the entire Middle Ages. And it's also worth noting that one of the reasons it was so big is, quote, the English clergy also granted the king a tax of a tenth later in 1290 because the expulsion of the Jews had pleased them so greatly, unquote. So, Edward gets his tax. The Jews have got a few months to get out of town. In the end, all things being equal, the kings of England had invited the Jews to London to perform an economic task for them. When, by the 1280s, that task was no longer possible for them to do, the kings of England, and one particular king of England, purged them from his kingdom. What could London's Jews do? They'd been simply given 3 months to leave. All Saints' Day had been fixed as the day by which they had to depart the country. How was this news communicated to the Jewish communities across England? We don't know. The royal commands probably would have been read aloud in synagogues. And to be honest, London always knew what was going on in Westminster, as news was spread along the streets fairly quickly. There is no evidence to show what the Jews themselves felt about this. If their voices were silenced by history, or if no one cared to even ask them at the time, we will perhaps never know. We cannot tell if they were angry or wearily resigned. They were allowed to take their chattels and goods with them when they left, but had to return to their debtors any pledges they still retained, their registered bonds, and above all, landed property, would fall to the king. So, all the properties owned by the Jews in London were going to become property of the king. Well, almost all of them. On the 27th of July 1290, safe conducts for the Jews were sent to the authorities in the Cinque Ports, and in the weeks that followed, several of the better connected Jews were the subject of royal exemptions to the expulsion order. A Jew called Aaron, son of Vives, was given royal permission to sell his houses in London and elsewhere to any Christian he felt like. On September the 1st, another notable member of the Jewish community was also granted permission by the king and his wife to sell some of his houses in London to Christian customers as he saw fit. But they were exceptions. Most of the properties went to the king, and I'll deal with what he did with them in a moment. There is nothing to suggest that the expulsion of the Jews of England went anything other than smoothly. And certainly the 2,000 to 4,000 or so departing Jews reached the ports of the English coast to get on their ships without any reports of violence. There are no reports of attacks or massacres. But that's where the story that started this chapter fits into it. The luring of Jewish passengers on board a ship in the mouth of the Thames onto the sandbanks at a low tide and their deliberate drowning. Whereas the Christians of England did not attack the Jews as they left. Once they got on the seas, all bets were off. That drowning in the River Thames was not the only example of such crimes. Go one river north up from the Thames and you come to the Crouch River in Essex. And supposedly, when a ship carrying Jewish passengers drifted into the shore near the town of Burnham on Crouch, the locals robbed them and murdered the lot of them. And we know that in 1293, a man called Henry Adrian was released from prison in Kent, where he, quote, had been detained therein for 2 years for the death of Jews, where he is charged, and for other trespasses committed upon the Jews in their passage to parts beyond the sea. Unquote. And yet, such piratical episodes are, while horrific, mercifully rare. The thousands took to the boats and sailed away. A few Jews did remain, mostly those who had converted to Christianity, it seems, and like that, quietly, surviving this last sting of danger and hatred, London's Jewish community passed into the realm of memory. The city could get down to the hard work of winding up their affairs. By the end of November, usurious elements of all outstanding Jewish loans were cancelled, so you didn't have to pay interest on the loans, but the substantives were to be retained. You still had to pay the basis of the loan, to the king, of course. Goods and valuables from 21 separate Jewish communities were all gathered up, bound in sealed chests, and brought to London on November 26. On December the 20th, 1290, a man called Hugh of Kendal, a highly experienced royal servant, was appointed by the king, quote, to value and sell all the houses, rents and tenements which late belonged to the king's Jews, unquote. Now the deal was that the sheriffs were to receive the money from the eventual sales and account for it at the exchequer. The process had started before the expulsion, and Kendall's job appears really had been mostly a matter of supervising the national process and making a final record of it. However, his lists do not detail all the Jewish property in England at the time, and as we said, certain Jewish community readers had been able to make sales before the forfeiture of their properties. And there's also other evidence to suggest that in the years leading up to 1290, a significant number of England's Jews had already sold off many of their properties by the time the confiscation order had come in. Nevertheless, Kendall's lists show that the most numerous and most valuable of the former Jewish properties were those in London. Together they were worth more than half the total value of all the Jewish properties sold after 1290. Records indicate that the king probably raised about £1,800 from the sale of London's Jewish properties or thereabouts. Some of this money he spent on glazing windows at Westminster Abbey, and some on the decoration of his father's tomb there. The English Jewish community was dissolved quickly and effectively over 1290 and 1291 with relatively little fuss. Not every ex-Jewish property was sold straight away, nor was every buyer prompt in their payments. Nevertheless, by the spring of 1291, the bulk of the hard work had been completed, and they were done. As to what happened to the Jewish exiles of 1290, we know pitifully little. Most would have probably fled in the first instance across the Channel to France. However, on the 16th of February in 1291, Philip IV ordered the expulsion of those Jews who just arrived from England, and they were pushed on. We do know some did gain the right to reside in France, because we've got records of them paying taxes to the French king in 1292, 1296 and 1297. However, by 1306, even those tenacious exiles would have been hard-pressed to survive. The general expulsion enacted in that year by the king that got rid of, well, that expulsion of Jews was the most significant suffered by the medieval Ashkenazic Jewry of Europe. But those who had in 1219 been expelled from England and then the next year told to move on from France ended up most probably scattered across Europe and beyond. Some have suggested that a few ended up in other parts of the British Isles. Others suggest they got as far away as the Mediterranean and even the Middle East. Over the round about two centuries before 1290, London's Jewish community had, with some difficulty, prospered in the 12th century and even during the 13th century when they were subject to vicious attacks and officially sanctioned persecution. The Jews of London had shown incredible enterprise, amazing resilience and quite profound adaptability. The medieval London Jewish community, and by extension the Jewish community of England, never achieved the cultural and religious creativity of their cousins in Normandy and northern France, the community from which they sprang. But given the shortness of time they existed here, what they did was genuinely remarkable. There's a small footnote to this story. In 1356, 66 years on from this date, a woman died in the outskirts of London. Her name was Claritin of Exeter, and she was the last survivor of London's Jewish community. How we know about her and how she survived is revealed in the place of her death, the Domus Conversorum, the religious house constructed on today's Chancery Lane for the residents of Jews who had converted to Christianity. As far as we can tell, Clarissa had been admitted to the Domus before 1280, presumably as a child, and had lived there, the daughter of one Jacob Copin, a Jew who had converted to Christianity and was a resident of the Domus as far back as the 1270s. It could have been that Clarissa had been born in the Domus. She had grown up there, grown older, left, moved to Exeter, married and had children of her own. And then in the 1330s, she returned to the Domus and remained there for the rest of her life. The London of her youth and of her old age were violently different places. As a girl, she was still nominally part of a struggling yet viable Jewish community. As an old woman, that community had been reduced to a distant memory, like the ghosts we see surround us in London today, signs on street corners, occasional buildings whose origins are forgotten. The vibrant, thriving heart of the Ashkenazi Jewish community of London was now little more than a district called Old Jewry. But you know what? For me, they were never just a footnote in London's history. They were a community brought into a foreign land by a king looking for people he could exploit. And they came and they settled and they flourished and they thrived. London had been good to them for a while. They had married and they had baked and they had raised children and they had worshipped God. They had become pillars of the community. They had helped turn London into the principal financial centre of the realm, alongside Christians and knightly orders. And yet, while there exist copious records of their dealings in terms of documentation covering loans and legal cases and asset disposition, the one thing we don't have much of is their own voices. Long-term listeners may remember the stilted but respectful encounter between one of London's Jewish community and the Abbot of Westminster Abbey, which I mentioned and covered all the way back in chapter 57. And there we do have a brief glimpse of a strident and intelligent Jewish community, gently pointing out that Christians' reading of certain passages of the Talmud are incorrect. Yet beyond this, really, there is mostly silence. A silence only broken by the dark deeds carried out upon London's medieval Jews. The attacks upon their community. The murders of Jews who annoyed the residents of the city. The pogroms inflicted, both fever-pitched and coldly legal. Until finally the last sound, the screams upon the river sands in the year 1290. The last cry of what had once been. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week for another chapter of The Story of London, a podcast that exists without adverts, as you may have noticed, and we accept kind donations from those listeners who feel, do you know what, they've sung for their supper and entertained me. However, if you don't feel like giving a donation, that's absolutely fine. You can, of course, give a absolutely free 5-star rating or review, which does help, because you've got these automatic algorithms that don't listen to anything and they just look at numbers and metrics and they throw the podcast out at people. So people go, oh, that looks new, and they start listening. So if you give a nice rating or review, it actually impresses the algorithm. All hail our robotic overlords. And if you don't feel like doing either, but you just enjoyed the episode, then I'm delighted. I'll be back again for another episode next week. Bye.